Lord, in the time of deep pain and darkness, where all seemed lost, in the blink of an eye, it changed. It all changed all at once. All of it. And even though it took their emotions a bit of time to catch up to it, you invited them to live in sync with this brand new reality, this resurrection reality. And I ask that today that you would do the same, that you would invade our lives with hope, with power, with joy, with surprise. And that you would allow us, Lord, to live in the time when we remember the incarnation, that we would be able to remember it and live into it, because we are on the other side of the cross and the resurrection. I ask for you to be moving in this time. I ask all this in your name, Jesus. Amen. Have you ever experienced sorrow so deep that you thought you might never get through it? Think for a moment. Have you ever gone through a time where your sorrow was so overwhelming that you thought you were going to be crushed by it? It's the typical way that it happens with deep sorrow, that typically it's very difficult to see out of it. Maybe it's the loss of a loved one. Maybe it's the loss of a job. Maybe it's being rejected or going through a breakup or perhaps going through a divorce. I'm a child of divorce. I remember a number of times when my parents were separated before they got divorced. And I remember laying on my bed with the feeling like I had an elephant sitting on my chest, and I could, the ringing in my ears and the deep sorrow and sadness that was just all over me. I never thought it would end, but it did. This is the kind of feeling that the followers of Jesus had following the time when Jesus was brutally killed on the cross, that their world was laid waste. They were riding the public opinion wave. They were riding this idea that Jesus was going to inaugurate the kingdom of God on earth. He was, and these 12 guys and this entourage around him would be the inner circle of the new king that would boot Rome out and would fix everything. But then it all came crashing down, all of it, devastating. They watched the master, the one who had invested his life in them, they watched him die on a cross. Actually, a couple of them did. The rest of them were just too scared. And they're completely and utterly devastated. And then, all of a sudden, all of that momentum into darkness came to a crashing halt and reversed all of a sudden. It was not only a surprise, but if you think about it, sorrow and sadness and all of the grief and all those emotions, they don't turn around at this, on a dime. It takes a little bit for them. It's kind of like steering a cruise ship rather than steering a speedboat. It takes a little while for your emotions to kind of catch up. And they're encountering all of this new data that no one has ever actually experienced before. They have no idea how to actually interpret what they're seeing. And the beautiful thing about John's gospel, really about all the gospels, is it's very honest. In terms of the misread of things and the gospel writers record that Mary is the first one in all four gospels. She's the first one to encounter the risen Christ, the first one. And it's a woman. And if you're trying to make a case in a court of law, in an ancient court of law, you don't want a woman as your primary witness, because a woman is going to disqualify you in the heartbeat. So that brings this thing into stark reality that this is what happened. This is how it occurred. This is an incredible event. And so basically what we're going to see in this passage from the first 18 verses of John 20, and John gives us these cameo appearances of Jesus after his resurrection that are so beautiful and so honest. And he basically gives different revelations of who he is after his resurrection in a very custom-fitted way to the different people that he's going to encounter. Thomas has a particular encounter with Jesus that John records. But this one is about the first one, Mary Magdalene. Mary Magdalene. Now, you're probably familiar with her, at least at some level, that she's the lead player in this particular drama. that she's part of the traveling entourage with Jesus. In case you didn't know, Jesus selected 12, is going to be basically turning over the keys to when he departs. But those weren't the only people that traveled with him. Actually, the entourage is probably quite large. And there were some women who traveled with him. Probably Mary Magdalene was one of these women who was part of the financial sponsorship that was actually keeping this group fed and clothed. But Mary Magdalene is also a person for whom Jesus cast out 7 demons from her. And so she's a person who has experienced this power and this authority of Jesus firsthand in this powerful way. 7 demons cast out of her. Now she's been freed. She has been treated for the first time by a man with complete dignity. Jesus has validated her as a person, and in fact, she actually gets to be, as some scholars would say, she's the first apostle, meaning she is the first one that carries, she's the first herald of the message that Christ has risen. This is Mary Magdalene. But Mary Magdalene is also, it's important to say in this, that I think a lot of times we associate her with the woman caught in adultery or the woman who is actually, the sinful woman who's actually washing Jesus' feet with her tears and drying them with her hair. That's not her. That's a different woman, but it just doesn't line up in that. So this is Mary Magdalene. She's part of the entourage. And here we are seeing, because of its honesty, we're hearing her. We're hearing an eyewitness. This is what happened. And so we're going to pick this up at verse 1 of John 18. No, I'm sorry, 20. Yeah, 20. Early on the first day of the week, when it was still dark, Mary Magdalene went to the tomb and saw that the stone had been removed from the entrance. And so she came running to Simon Peter and the other disciple, the one Jesus loved. I love the way that John refers to himself that way. And she said, "They have taken the Lord out of the tomb, and we don't know where they have put him." And so, like many people, after a loved one dies, she wants to go to the place where they have laid him to rest. She wants to go and grieve there near this person, even though it's only a body. She wants to go and be near this one that she's lost, this one that completely changed her life. She's still actually technically in the dark about what has actually happened. And so she arrives at the tomb. She finds a stone rolled back. She's distressed. And what does she think? She thinks grave robbers is what's going on here. She thinks that somebody has robbed the tomb. And in those days, people robbed graves basically to steal 2 things, the linens and the spices. And honestly, you know, if you've done any reading on archaeology at all, grave robbing is a very long and old tradition. Because it's easy money. It's going in and plundering something that's already just sitting there static, just waiting to be taken there. And that's how Mary sees this. She thinks that this is just another knife in the gut, a twist of the knife of the death of the one that she loves. However, in this, and as she bolts back, her initial read is wrong. Her initial read of what's going on is actually quite out of sync with what is actually going on. And that brings us into verse 3. So Peter and the other disciple started for the tomb. Both were running, but the other disciple outran Peter and reached the tomb first. I like the way that John kind of says, I'm a lot faster than Pete. He bent over and looked in at the strips of linen lying there, but he did not go in. And then Simon Peter came along behind him and went straight into the tomb. And he saw the strips of linen lying there, as well as the cloth that had been wrapped around Jesus' head. The cloth was still lying in its place, separate from the linen. Finally, the other disciple, who had reached the tomb first, also went inside. He saw and believed. They still did not understand from the scripture that Jesus had to rise from the dead. Then the disciples went back to where they were staying. They just could not figure out what they're interpreting. And it's interesting, firstly, that the younger disciple, the younger, let's just say, faster disciple, is John. And that's what most scholars believe in this context here. And he arrives first, and he obeys the Jewish custom. And that is that when you're not supposed to have, if you have contact with a dead body, it makes you ceremonially unclean. You have to go through a whole set of rituals and a whole bunch of time to be able to actually even have normal contact with people. On top of that, a criminal who has been crucified, who is dead, makes you so ceremonial and unclean. And so John is obeying the Jewish custom, but he stands outside of the tomb looking at, what am I looking at? What is happening here? And huffing, Peter arrives, and he goes straight in. Who cares? Who cares if this makes me unclean? This is my friend. But then Peter looks in there, and he says, something's not right here. I mean, if grave robbers came, they would have not stolen the body. They would have stolen the linens and the spices. But the treasure's still here. Something is not really computing, that instead of a total mess, he finds this far too orderly. This context with the treasure still there and no body, what in the world is going on? Now, I think it's important to say that for Peter and for John, that only days before, perhaps 3 days before, there was another grave scene that they were a part of. 3 days, probably. Lazarus. Jesus came and raised Lazarus from the dead, but Lazarus, as you recall, he comes out of the dead kind of, you know, he comes out with all the grave clothes on. Do you understand what I'm saying? He's got the grave clothes on. Here we have grave clothes, no body. There we had grave clothes and a body. So something else is going on here. And I think that John wants us to understand that Lazarus was resuscitated. He came back to life, but he was going to die again. Jesus actually did not get resuscitated. He was resurrected. That is to say that Jesus didn't get rescued from death. Jesus passed through death. That's how scholars would say this. He passed through death into a completely other order of existence. He never dies again. He rises in physical form, and is in a completely different existence than any human being on earth has ever been in before. And this is our Jesus. Finally, John enters the tomb, and I think it's starting to dawn on him. It's empty. The treasures are still here. Didn't Jesus say something about this? Listen carefully. John starts to see the evidence through the eyes of faith. And it changes what he sees. It starts to dawn on John. He starts to see things, what he's seeing through the words of Jesus. He starts to see things through the promises of Jesus. And it just causes things to look different. Do you see that? That John sees this and believes. And it says in verse 11, now Mary stood outside the tomb crying. So the boys, they left. They went back to the place where they were staying. And it says, now Mary stood outside the tomb crying. And as she wept, she bent over to look into the tomb and saw two angels in white seated where the body had been, one at the head and the other at the foot. And they asked her, woman, why are you crying? They have taken the Lord away, she said, and I don't know where they have put him. So Mary has straggled along behind Peter and John. They leave. She stays. She's weeping and weeping and weeping. And through her tears and her puffy eyes, she sees these two people that I think later probably she found out were angels, but maybe she knew right off the bat, these are angels. And she, as she looks through these tears, and I read this as I was studying for this, I read a very interesting quote. It was, angels are best seen through tears. I think that's a very interesting, I'm not sure I buy it, but I really like it. She sees two angels. Two angels. Dos, two. For any Jew that would see two angels, they would have one thing that would come into their mind. Do you know what it is? The Ark of the Covenant. The Ark of the Covenant is a place on the top, on the mercy seat, the place where God meets people, are two angels. And below it, the place where atonement and forgiveness comes. And there are two angels here. For any Jew, they would come to that immediately. For us Gentiles, well, it would probably just pass by us. But in this case, it's two angels. And she still thinks, even seeing them, that somebody has stolen Jesus' body. But then she becomes aware of someone else that's present here. And it says in verse 14, at this she turned around and saw Jesus standing there. But she did not realize that it was him. And he asked her, "Woman, why are you crying? Who is it you are looking for, or who do you seek?" Well, thinking that he was the gardener, she said, "Sir, if you have carried him away, tell me where you have put him, and I will go and get him." Like this little woman is going to go lug a corpse out, but she's just desperate. Two questions. It's interesting because questions have a very curious effect on a human soul. That they have a way of bringing out something in us or bringing us into something, the reality of something that nothing else does. Questions put us in discovery mode. And that's what's going on here. This is going on constantly, actually, with Jesus. In his interactions with people, he's constantly asking questions. But the questions typically have a lot of different dimensions of purpose in people's lives. I mean, the Lord constantly asks me questions when I'm listening, and he asks me a question, and I know it's him because it's a question I would never ask. It's something I would never come up with in my own, you know, conscience or anything like that. And he would ask me things like, how's that working for you? You know, if I'm bitter or struggling with something or whatever, and the Lord might ask, hey, how's that working for you? And maybe the Lord is asking you that today too. How's that working for you? How's that set of choices and that direction that you're going in life? How's that working for you? And then that causes you to have to discover, well, wait a minute, let me backtrack a second and pull that apart. Are you sure that's the direction you want to go? Here's a familiar one that we'll see in a few weeks. Do you love me? Do you love me? 3 times. How long has he been this way? How long have you been this way? And I think it's interesting because the angel knows, firstly, the angels, when they ask Mary this question, why are you crying? I like the way that scholar Daryl Johnson says, he says that the angels know that Mary's tears of sorrow do not flow in sync with this new reality. Her tears flow out of sync with this new reality. Why are you crying? Why are you crying? She doesn't recognize Jesus because of the pain that she's experiencing. And the pain somehow has a blinding effect on her. I think this is a common thing for all human beings. I think that our pain can blind us from Jesus. That the thing that we're going through right now somehow has a temporary blinding effect on us, and we miss him in it. But he is there. He is very much there. And we have no idea when actually Jesus rose from the dead. We don't know exactly when it happened. It could have happened at midnight. That's when the Orthodox Christians, that branch of our faith in the East, they celebrate Easter at midnight on Saturday night because that's the kind of the first part of the third day, and that's when they think that Jesus rose. Who knows? We just don't know. Why are you crying? And then, I believe the ultimate question, who is it that you are seeking? Who are you looking for? Not what are you looking for. Actually, she came to the grave looking for a what? Looking for a body. Looking for a dead Lord. That's a what? But now Jesus says, who are you looking for? And I think that this is the ultimate question in life. Who are you looking for? Who are you seeking? What are you? And if we spend our time seeking on what, the what will never satisfy us. But if you spend your time seeking the who and you find the who, the what comes with the who. I'm not talking about Cindy Lou Who. I'm talking about Jesus is the who. You know what I'm talking about? That what ends up happening is that when we focus on peace, and I want to seek after peace, and I want to seek after forgiveness, and I want meaning, and I want purpose, and I want direction, I want all these different things, and it's so elusive. It's like trying to grab a bar of soap, and a very slippery bar of soap. It seems to squirt out of our hands. But if you grab a hold of the who, the what comes with him. That the peace and the reconciliation, the forgiveness, the meaning, the purpose, the direction, all those things come in the who, not in the what. And so the question that I have to ask you and me this morning is, who are you seeking or what are you seeking? And that will be not just the game changer for this Christmas season, it will be the game changer forever. That is the game changer. Who are you seeking? Who are you seeking? It all comes with Him. It all comes with Him. She turns around and she thinks, it's the gardener. Interestingly enough, in a way, going all the way back to Eden, it is. He's the one who's tending the creation. He's the one who's turning things around. And it says in verse 16, Jesus said to her, Mary. What's the tone of that? I don't know. I can think of so many ways. Mary, 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 Mary. Hey, Mare. I don't know. But she turned toward him and she cried out in Aramaic. That's the language that normal people spoke, just regular common language today. Rabboni, which means teacher. It's not until Jesus calls her name that she actually recognizes him. It's not until he calls her name that now all of a sudden she realizes it's him. And this is the way that it has always worked. I know that I'm allegorizing a little bit here, but this is the way that it works, is that with Jesus, it is not until you hear his voice call your name that this all becomes real to you. It never does. Not for a single soul. So Jesus starts out as an idea. Well, that Jesus, maybe he's somehow associated with Christmas and manger scenes and different kind of things like that and presents and all these different things. And then he goes from an idea maybe to a person. Well, he's the one that's in that little manger there. And then he's also, you know, then maybe it goes from there to he's a person. Then he's a good teacher. Then he's not just a good teacher, but he's somebody that said a lot of really good things, but then suffered really cruelly. And they killed him. I mean, I think that's what some of those Christian people do with the God thing at a certain time in Easter or a certain time in spring. And then perhaps you hear he goes from idea to person to good teacher to someone who suffered to someone who rose. What? Now somebody out there is coming closer, 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 closer in your and my understanding of who he is. Then he becomes personal. Wait a minute. He becomes someone to you. Then he calls you by name. I don't mean that he says Bob. Of course he doesn't say Bob to you. That wouldn't make sense. But when he calls your name, somehow you know that he is addressing you first person singular. And when the maker of the universe addresses you first person singular, that's when the lights come on. Does that make sense? It's when the lights come on in all of us, and it is not until that name, your name is called, that makes any sense. That voice, for her, it took her into a completely new reality. For you and me, it takes us into a completely new reality as well. And in verse 17, it says that Jesus said to her, "Do not hold on to me." I think that, honestly, the reason why he said this is because she throws her arms around him. That's what any normal person would do. Do not hold on to me, for I have not yet ascended to my Father. But go instead to my brothers and tell them, I am ascending to my Father and your Father, to my God and your God. Well, Mary went to the disciples with the news, I have seen the Lord. And she told them what he had said, that he had said all of these things to her. So as I said, she throws her arms around her. He redirects her. She sees his face and hears his voice. We just hear his voice. But those things actually turn us. And so I want to ask you the question this morning before I go on. Have you heard Jesus calling you? And if you have you responded to him? If you have you responded? Because once he has become personal, once he starts addressing you, and you start to get it that he's addressing you first person singular, you have a moment of choice. And that choice will change everything. Everything. Thus the title of this message. This changes everything. This is not a clever marketing scheme. Jesus didn't come to create a new, clever marketing scheme for human beings to get on board with. No, this actually is the thing that changes everything. It's not an Audi car. It's not a Mercedes-Benz. It's not any of those different things that say this changes everything. This actually changes everything. And so, with this, what are we to make of this? I think in these last statements, there are a number of things that really register for us in our souls. And so let me just hit these things very quickly. In the resurrection, and this is for your fill-in-the-blanks in your bulletins. In the resurrection, a new creation has been birthed. Or this is a new creation event, a new order of things, a new reality has come through Jesus' death and resurrection. And so if you think about this, going back, we're almost at the end of John, and at the very beginning of John, John sets it up in the prologue. And in case you, and John is a bit different than other gospels in that he sets up the main themes at the very beginning of his gospel. It's sort of like, I don't know if you remember the movie Star Wars when it came out in 1977. Some of you aren't even born then, but anyway, I saw it 11 times with its different date every time. Because I just couldn't get enough of it. It was the coolest thing ever. But I remember listening to the music just grabbed a hold of me and pulled me into the story. But the interesting thing is, at the very beginning, and you know that, but in the midst of that, that is the prologue of an orchestral movement. And all of the main themes are woven into that main theme. That's how a main title works in a movie, especially a John Williams written score. And so in that you have Darth Vader's theme and Luke Skywalker's theme and all of these other Obi-Wan's theme, and all of them are woven in. And that's what John is doing at the beginning of his gospel. He's giving us the main title that has all the themes that he's going to be speaking about and writing about in the gospel. And so it goes like this back in John 1. We're looking at this new creation idea. In the beginning was the Word. And the Word was with God. And the Word was God. He was with God in the beginning. Through him, all things were made. Without him, nothing was made that was made. And so there we have creation. Really important. He's anchoring us back into Jesus and into Genesis 1:1 as well. And then fast forward to verse 11. He came to that which was his own, but his own people did not receive him. Yet to all who did receive him, those who believed in his name, he gave the right to become children of God, children not born of natural descent nor of human decision nor a husband's will. He's saying, you don't have to be a Jew to get in on this. That's what's being said there. But he said, instead, but born of God. That's a new creation. He talks to Nicodemus, remember, about this idea of being born again. And the new birth is part of how all this works. It's a new creation thing. Creation, new creation, all of this is happening in Jesus' death and resurrection. Creation, new creation, all birthed to us in a fresh way in the resurrection. And anyone who receives him, receives this new birth and this new creation event now, is on your insides. That's what the New Testament, Paul's writing that over and over and over again. All the New Testament writers are trying to explain that this death and resurrection reality of Jesus now has come into you to reside in you when Jesus comes in you. And so there is a death thing going on, a death dynamic, and a resurrection dynamic that's going on in you if you receive him. This is part of what we get. Actually, this is not part. This describes what we get. Everything else is filler. So therefore, I'm sorry, that's a little too, yeah, it's not all, none of it's filler. It's all God. So that's incorrect. But because of this, the Apostle Paul can say, with resounding confidence, if anyone is in Christ, in union with Christ, if has Christ living inside of him, the new creation has come. The old is gone. The new is where? Where? It's here. The new is gone. I mean, the new is here, the old is gone. So now sin's reign has ended. That is to say, that's not to say that you'll never sin again, but that sin doesn't have you anymore. that evil's reign is over. It's been broken. That doesn't mean that evil is not here, but it means that evil's authority over you has been broken. Now, because of Jesus' death and resurrection, that death, which was the final ominous thing over us, it doesn't have the final word anymore. Those three things were dealt with, the death blow with Jesus dying on the cross. Sin and evil and death all taken into Jesus' body when he dies on the cross. Something fundamentally has changed about the entire cosmos, about the way that the whole creation works now. And we have the chance to live into it because that reality has been released for us and to us. And now, hear me, this is the best way I know how to say this. Now we're invited to live in sync with this new reality, not in sync with the old reality. And this would be what we call the Christian life, that we are now living in sync with something that has already happened, that has permanence, that has stability, that we anchor into that and we live in and through and out of that, in this old way that we used to think, that we used to live, that we used to value, that we used to put our value, you know, up for public opinion polls. No longer. That we live in sync with this new reality. Does that make sense to you? But that's something that you actually have to agree with at some point. That I'm not going to live in agreement with this old reality, but with this new one. I'm not going to live in agreement with the guy who's, I'm just using myself as an example here, who's damaged goods because his parents are separated twice and divorced and dad's a con man. I'm not going to live in sync with that. I'm going to live in sync with a different reality. It's beautiful because this Thanksgiving, not all of our kids got to be there. Daniel and Amelia live in Michigan. But Hannah, Karis, and Bex and their significant others were all there. Bill and Grace there, brother-in-law, soon-to-be sister-in-law. What we get to experience, is this new reality. The inheritance that I inherited from Jack Branch, my father, I'm not in sync with that. I'm in sync with a different inheritance. I'm in sync with a new reality. And I'm getting to experience that with these people that I love so much, and they are getting to experience the fact that I, at one point in time, and over a long period of time, have continued to come out of sync with that old reality and into sync with the new one. What about you? What about you? Are you still living in sync with the old reality? Think for a moment. I'm not pointing the finger. I'm actually using the finger to say, come with me. Come with Jesus on this. That this resurrecting, this death and resurrection event, it has changed everything. And now there is a new reality. It is not just going to happen somehow in the future. It has happened. And now we get to live into it. Secondly, that through the resurrection, Jesus now shares, and I think this is maybe the most wonderful thing out of all of it for me personally as a sort of a raised by wolves guy. But through the resurrection, Jesus now shares his relationship with his Father, with me. That is to say, now that we are family. I am family. There's something that Jesus is saying here, and I think it's easy for us to miss, but up until this point in time, Jesus has referred to all of his followers as disciples, as servants, as friends. This is the first time that he refers to them as brothers. Because something has happened. That something, when Jesus said, it is finished, it is accomplished, something has happened that has an adoption sort of a smell to it, fragrance to it. That somehow this payment that was paid by Jesus' blood on the cross has now invited us into this adopted family, that now we become brothers of his. So he calls his disciples now brothers, and anyone who names him is Lord. Now you're a brother of Jesus. I mean, how good is that? I mean, what in the world? the master, the maker of the universe, you're now being called a brother? That Jesus is your brother? I mean, really? I mean, for his physical brothers on earth, that would be a train wreck. I mean, can you imagine having Jesus as your older brother? Well, he's perfect. You know, like, okay, Mom, I'm not perfect like my big brother. Like, well, of course, because he's God. And then he calls them brothers, but then he says this, and he says, I'm going to my Father and your Father, my God and your God. Now something even deeper and something bigger, because before, again, in John's gospel, he's called him the Father. He's called the Father who sent me. He's called, Jesus has called his Father my Father, but now he says he is their Father. He is our Father. That's a big deal. That is really the big thing that has been reversed, that has changed here, so that through his death and resurrection, his disciples and you and me are now welcome into the family to enjoy, say that word with me, enjoy the same relationship with the Father that Jesus has, because that is the one that has been shared with us. And so this is what Jesus actually prayed in John 17. Remember that? I pray, he says, Jesus prays this to the Father, that all of them may be one, Father, just as you are in me and I am in you, may they also be in us. May they be in us. Like in complete union, just the same way that we are. And then in verse 26, I have made you known to them, Father, and will continue to make you known to them, in order that the love that you have for me would be in them. So the love that the Father has for Jesus now would be in Russell. And the love that the Father has for Jesus would now be in Dave. And the love that is coming, just radiating and shining, you're my son whom I love, I'm well pleased with you, it's coming into Jody. Because of what Jesus has done now, that same relationship that Jesus has, that has now been given to us. That's not hyperbole. It's not something so abstract or hocus pocus. Now I get to have that same relationship with the Father. Years ago, I told this story. It's Baxter Kruger's story. He's a Trinitarian theologian, but he tells the story this way. He's a Southern guy, loves Ole Miss, went to Ole Miss, University of Mississippi. And he's sitting in on game day, Saturday morning. He's sitting there in his Barca Lounge or whatever it is, and he's watching the Ole Miss football game, and he sees out of the corner of his eye two camouflage-clad people in the doorway. And they rush him and attack him, and there commences a wrestling match on the floor. It's his son and another little boy, and they are wrestling and shooting each other and having this full contact battle and all of this playing rough that mom's going to say somebody's going to get hurt. You know what I'm talking about? It's that kind of stuff. And this full contact thing goes on for about 45 minutes. And at the end, they're all sweaty. They're all lying there. He said, I have been killed, I don't know, 20 or 30 times. And then at the whole thing, as they're all just laying there, panting on the floor, he realizes that he doesn't even know the name of the kid that he's been playing with the whole time. Turns out his name is Stephen. And the reason why Stephen got to experience all of this joy and all of this full contact wrestling with Baxter's son is because he knew the Father through Baxter's son. That he was invited into that same relationship, and now he could participate in that relationship with Baxter's son. He was in relationship with Baxter's son and now was in this completely free, full contact relationship with Baxter as a result. And I think that's such a beautiful picture of what's now been given to you and I in Jesus. This is an amazing thing that Jesus has done, that now, and I say this word intentionally, now we get to enjoy this relationship. This is a relationship we actually get to enjoy. Not just that we get to go to heaven at the end and not have to experience the full weight of our sins. This is a relationship that has been bought and paid for by the Son of God so that you can live into that new reality right now. I like the way that theologian N.T. Wright says it. He said that something has altered decisively. Something has been achieved. A new relationship has sprung up like a sudden spring flower. the disciples are welcomed into a new world where they can know God the way that Jesus knew God, where they can be intimate children with their Father. Jesus' entire identity was wrapped up in his relationship with his Father, and now we are invited into that same reality. And the more we live into that reality, the more freedom we get to experience. That brings us to the last one and the shortest one. It would be really important not to miss this, and that is the idea here, the fact that Jesus, in fact, is alive and has passed through death into a new order of existence. On this side of Easter, we actually get to share a relationship with Jesus that is better than the one that Mary Magdalene and the 12 experienced before that day. This is a whole new order of existence. Think about it for a moment. What they experienced after Easter with Jesus was different than what they experienced with him before it. Before that, they did not have this kind of resurrection power pulsing through their veins. They were with him, yes. But if you think about it, that what Jesus accomplished on the cross brought such a new reality into the existence that none of them had ever even imagined. I could see some of you kind of thinking, is that right? Could that be possibly right? Think about that. And if you disagree with me in the final analysis, I'm okay with that. But I believe I'm right in this. That what they experience and what we experience on the other side of the resurrection is a completely new game changer. And I think if Peter was with us sitting right here, he would say, oh, please, it isn't even close to being the same. What we had before and what we had after, completely different. And so the Apostle Paul can write to the Philippian Christians in chapter 3, and he can say this. He said, I gave up all that inferior stuff so that I may know Christ personally and experience his resurrection power. There's a lot more that goes with that. But think about that. This is what this is all about. Now you get to know the Father like Jesus knows the Father. Wow. And so the question comes at the end of this. Do you know this one? Do you know this Jesus? Do you love him?